Welcome to Radio Shalom, local radio in Copenhagen. We send on FM 87.6 megahertz, but can always stream from the website of radioshalom.dk. Your mediator today is the psychologist Benjamin Katz, and we have a guest called Mario Hein, and me on the technique is Shai Gabay.
We are going to make a program about the usefulness of psychology and also transcendental thinking and even visions. We are going to weave them together, and we are going to do it with Mario Hein, who is a psychologist, and Olga Cohen, who joined us, and you, Shai Gabay. I am the mediator, Benjamin Katz. Please, Mario, start to tell about your life, so we get a picture of what psychology really means in a lifetime.
Okay. Well, to start with, my parents met in India. So I grew up in India, a Greek mother and a Danish father in Bombay, India. And Bombay in those days was a really a big city with all sorts of cultures mixed up. It was post-colonial England, India, and so there was a lot of British influence still, but it was a country in transition. So what happened there was I was part of the elite. I mean, all white people were elite, together with the upper class Indians. And so that was my upbringing, was amongst privileged people. At the same time as we had privileged people all around us at the schools and so clubs and so on, I was mainly brought up by our servants. Mm-hmm. Because, and they were Hindu people from the countryside. They were basically farmers who could earn more money by coming to the big city and serving rich people. And so I have this double influence, the influence from both, shall we say, very simple people, but very nice and intelligent people, but who absolutely no pretensions of any sort, and the upper class, very pretentious lot that my family was socializing with. So I went to a British school, and again, to show you what a big mix it was a British school run by Spanish Jesuit priests.
A nice mixture.
Right? Yeah. And but it was the British school system. And I was in a class, for example, I checked my class photo and counted how many were we in my class. Right? Mm-hmm. And we were 49 pupils. And of the 49 pupils, some were Parsis, some were Hindus, some were Muslims, some were Christians. That was our mix.
International school.
It was a real mix. So yeah. I think this has, you know, something important in where I stand today is that I was party up to such a mix of cultural influences, both rich and poor, and diversity of people. And my best friend was a Japanese boy, right? I mean, because his family was also posted in
India. But the language was English, right?
English was the common language in those days. And so that was, you know, my early background. But later on, my father was a Dane.
Yes.
And he had been posted in India for over 30 years, and they recalled him. So there I was, 13 years old, and left the warm, hot climate and the multicultural mix of of Bombay and came to Copenhagen, Denmark, which was a totally homogeneous society. Everything is the same here. And we came in March, so everything was the same weather-wise also. You know, it was just gray, gray, gray. Cool. And I came from this colorful, you know, where either the sun was beating on your head or it was pitch black at night and so on. And now everything was quiet and gray.
So we are back in the 60s in Copenhagen.
We are in 1963.
Okay, wow. Beginning of the 60s, yes.
In Copenhagen. And that was, you know, a big shift. Mm-hmm. So I went to a Danish school where everybody was nice and Danish and and quiet and all looked the same. And, all were basically the same social status and so on. So everything was, again, homogeneous. I mean, there was no mix of anything. Mm-hmm. I came and they thought I was very colorful.
Okay. You had temperament.
Not so much that. I was just dark-haired.
You were looking different.
And I looked slightly different. I dressed. I remember it was Cliff Richard and Elvis in those days, right? So I had lots of Brill cream in my hair and, you know, the wave. Yeah. And nobody else had that in Copenhagen.
Okay.
Right? They were all, you know, without all that greasy stuff. And it took me a little time to realize that maybe I shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
Maria, do you remember your feelings when you came to Denmark? You know, like this feeling to come to another land.
I think my basic feelings was boredom.
Boredom.
Boredom, yes. Boredom, because I came from a...
Did it change?
Not for the first several years. For the first several years, I was bored in Denmark.
Yes.
I mean, because I didn't have really many friends.
No.
And it was only when I went to gymnasium that I really got friends. And
What about the language? I mean,
I had to learn Danish.
Yeah, you had to learn Danish very quickly. Learn,
because my dear dad didn't teach me anything. He was a very impatient man, so so he couldn't teach me Danish. Okay. And my mother didn't know any Danish, so she tried to teach me Danish.
So which languages can you speak?
I can speak English.
Yes.
And Danish.
And Danish.
My mother could speak seven languages.
Yeah.
She didn't teach me any of them. I mean, for example, she could have taught me Greek, which was her mother tongue, but I didn't learn any Greek. My father could have taught me Danish. Mm-mm.
No.
And they were speaking English together, right? And neither of them were, you know.
So no Hindi or...
Nothing. So I came to Denmark basically just speaking English.
So when you was living in India, you didn't understand the local language.
Slightly, you know. Okay. I knew a few words here and there, right? Mm. And so I could, you know, make my way out.
Okay, but these local people who took care of you, did they speak English?
Yes.
Okay.
In those days, it was the common language in India.
Okay.
Now it isn't anymore. If you go to India now, if you talk to a taxi driver in English, he doesn't understand you. In those days, all the taxi drivers spoke English.
Hmm.
I mean, things were different because it was just after the colonial rule of England.
Yeah.
So, they had their independence in 49.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the 50s, everything was still very much
English,
like that.
Yeah.
So you had your teenage period in Denmark.
Yeah.
How did you manage this teenage period in Denmark?
As I said, it was until I was around 16 and started getting Danish friends.
That's okay, lucky.
Right, and then everything, you know, got better.
Okay.
I mean, for example, I started playing bridge. The card game bridge with three other guys in my first year in gymnasium, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So when we had a eating period, then we would play cards while we were eating our lunch, right? And we still do.
Yeah. Okay.
The four of us still meet.
Still hang together.
We're still buddies and play bridge.
It's amazing.
But that was when I started socializing with Danes.
Yeah.
But I think, like, when you came to Denmark, you said that you were looking, like, very different than Danes.
Yeah.
So I think you were get used to get a lot of attention. I mean,
I don't think I was aware of it.
You wasn't
aware of it. I mean, it was, it was shortly there around there. The Vietnam War was prominent, and there was a great anti-American feeling in Denmark in those days.
Yes, okay.
Very anti-American, and people who didn't know me, they would call me the American. Yeah.
Mm. Okay.
It was really a
put down. I mean, okay.
Because of your look, because you talk English.
Because I was different, so I spoke English. He must be American, right? Yeah. And Americans were not looked on with.
So different was not something good.
No.
Okay. Mm.
Definitely not.
Mm. Okay.
Later on, it was, but not then.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So this could be described as the biggest impression in your childhood that formed somehow your future.
This variety of upbringing, right? From the very colorful to the very drab, to lots of friends and activities to limited things. Mm-hmm. Also, my parents were wealthy people in India due to various circumstances. Mm-hmm. But when they came to Denmark, they were not. They were just middle-class Danes.
So it was a very big change for you.
Oh, yeah.
Like weather,
oh, yeah.
Country,
I mean,
culture,
I had servants.
Also the social position.
Yeah.
Yeah. From
exactly.
So when you came to Denmark, what kind of flat did you get?
My mother was a bridge champion in India.
Bridge, okay. Yeah.
And she was playing a very renowned club in India, together with all the rich Indians, and they would play for money.
Yeah.
Right? So when she came to Denmark, she had in those days the equivalent of 30 or 40,000 kroner in cash, which was good for a down payment on a house. Right?
So you lived in a house.
Yes. So they bought a house. In those days, the house cost 250,000 kroner.
Yes. Yeah.
So you can see her money down on the house meant that we could move in a very nice big house, which was actually above our standard.
Okay.
But it was in a good area and
in Copenhagen. Or?
Yeah, just outside Copenhagen.
Okay.
So I mean, this is the fluctuations in my youth, in childhood, and youth.
Yeah. Mario, in this period, let's say from 0 to 20, when do you start to feel that you are your own, that you just don't conform? Where do you make it?
From the very start, I felt like an outsider.
Okay.
Right? I mean, in India, I'm an outsider. I'm white, right?
Yeah.
So you were
privileged,
the ugly
white,
duckling,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm an outsider. Yeah. Come to Denmark, and I'm an outsider, right? So in that sense, circumstances help me retain my okay. I'm different.
Yeah, you learn to live in peace with this.
Yes.
Yeah. What does it mean to be an outsider?
Well, that I'm not. I feel that I'm outside the group.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you're better. Or
no, in India we were told that we were better.
Okay.
I mean, it was blatant racism in those days, right? So white people were genetically superior to Indians. And unfortunately for that view is that my schoolmates were Indian, the servants were Indian, and I really liked all those people and didn't consider them inferior in any way because I was dealing with them, you know, living with them, and they were nicer people than my parents and their friends, so I didn't really buy the... Yeah.
To be the outsider means to be different, not to... Okay.
Yeah.
Not belonging to a group and obeying the rules of the group.
Okay.
Yeah.
But Mario, you have chosen a piece of music which is not Indian or Danish. You have chosen Wagner.
Yes.
And it's called the Ten House Overture.
Yes, because...
A special reason for your choice that we are going to listen to in a minute.
Yes, because in India, there were periods where all my friends... I would mainly play in my in the afternoons with other white kids who were living in the neighborhood. And sometimes there were no white kids living in the neighborhood. So then I would read books. And one of the books that I loved really greatly was Tarzan.
Tarzan,
by Edgar Rice Burroughs. Yes. Right? So I would read all the Tarzan books and so on. And then I would fantasize that I was Tarzan. And Tannhäuser was a great piece of music to jump around doing heroics like Tarzan in my underpants, you know.
Okay, so let's try to listen to it. It starts very quiet and then it gets a bit louder.
Okay, so that was the heroics of Tarzan. You must imagine me jumping around on the bed and imagining I was Tarzan of the apes. Well, it was pretty far from reality, right? But I mean, I had a good imagination, and that was important too, the daydreaming and that sort of stuff. And... The question of being different, an outsider, and so on, it all changed once I came started studying. Because once I became a student, finished my gymnasium, and started studying at the university, things changed again. Because now I didn't really feel an outsider anymore. I mean, I was getting girlfriends and Danish girlfriends and that sort of thing. So that really helped integrate me into Danish society. Okay. And also the moving into academia and so on. And I started off reading medicine, but I didn't really like that studies. And the only thing that really interested me in the university studying medicine was psychology. They called it medicine psychologie.
Yeah. Mm.
And in those days, you had free Elgang, you know, open. You could move around very liberally to any subject you wanted. So I went up and asked the professor in psychology if you had to have the little Latin test in psychology, because you had to have it in medicine, and you know, I had to learn Danish and also Latin, she said, no, you don't have to. And so I switched the next day to psychology.
Okay.
What practicing a psychologist meant for you life, your attitude to life?
Well, you know, you meet a lot of people,
yeah.
And you listen to a lot of people and in their various ways of dealing with life, and a lot of them are suffering. Some of them can't help suffering because they're born with a handicap or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And others, you know, they suffer because they deal with life in a way that's mm-hmm. makes it even more difficult than necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And when you meet so many people with so many different life stories, and yet there's a similar thing happening in all of them. I mean, in all of them, they have the same sort of way of dealing with their problems, which makes their problems even worse, right? Mm-hmm. And so that even though they're all very diverse and different people individually and so on, there's still this common thread that you see as a psychologist and try to deal with.
Then you started to interest yourself for Castaneda.
Oh, that I did while I was studying, even. And that, I think, was maybe also due to my past in India and so on.
But everybody read Carlos Castaneda on that time, no?
No, actually, no. Because when I was reading Castaneda, everybody was reading Marx.
Okay.
University, yeah, that's right.
At the university. Yeah. And that was one of the ways you ask, you know, how you don't groupthink.
Yeah.
It annoyed me immensely that everybody was trying to school me in Marx and tell me what the objective reality was according to Marx and so on. And, you know, that just pissed me off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So I didn't join those things. And in those days, it was actually quite difficult to find somebody to teach you anything in a university who wasn't a Marxist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There were a few, and then you found out who they were and studied there.
Yeah. And then where you also differed, it was the matter of science fiction, which you introduced to me.
Oh, yeah. Science fiction, I've always read, you know, when I didn't read Tarzan, I was reading Edgar Rice Burroughs also wrote Princess of Mars.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's actually he wrote prior to Tarzan, which is a science fiction book.
Science fiction, that's right. Right? Yeah.
And so I was reading all sorts of science fiction because we didn't have television in those days, not in India at all. Mm. So I would go and read books. I would read 2-3 books a week.
Science fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mainly science fiction and adventure stories and that sort of stuff as a boy, right?
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, so years passed by and you became a little bit older. When you look at Mario traveling this journey, what do you see? What do you highlight? Because we talk about 10 more years back.
Yeah.
Left, yeah.
Left, right, yeah.
Well, if you asked me a few years ago, what are you? I would have said I'm a humanist.
Mm-hmm.
Today, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say I'm a humanist because, amongst other things, I looked up what it means to be a humanist.
what does it mean?
The definition?
It means that it was very much a question of talking about the rational mind and that human beings can lead a moral, ethical life without being religious.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right, so it was taking a distance from religion and, shall we say, emancipating ourselves from the religious doctrines.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that, and today I would say I'm returning, and I say we have to have a transcendental aspect to our lives, and that everything is not just a question of materialism.
Why? Mm-hmm. Why did what made you change your mind?
Psilocybin.
What? What did you say?
I said psilocybin.
What's
that? Psilocybin.
Space Nine hat. Yeah. That's a little mushroom.
Mushrooms.
Okay. Ah, okay. Yeah. Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. It opened some doors there.
Yeah, I met God. Or rather, I met the divine because it wasn't a person or something, but I had some experiences in that state of mind, which I later on, when I have studied religious philosophy and so on, I say, I encountered what the Hindus would call Brahman, or the Atman Brahman thing, where so I had that experience there for me, which together with my previous, shall we say, engagement with Carlos Castaneda, yoga, Zen Buddhism, and all that sort of stuff, which I read a lot of, this was sort of confirming that point of view. And it has increased the older I get and the more I'm dealing with, shall we say, humanism and political problems in the West and so on, it becomes clearer and clearer for me that we cannot solve these problems that we see in the West by just taking a materialistic stance and say, oh, we have to live ethical, moral lives and being human is enough. We just have to be that kind of humans who do the right thing, and then you'll have political correctness and all that shit telling you what to do and how to behave. And I don't think that's the right way of going to it. I think that's a fallacy, and it's sort of we are falling into an ego trap that our egos somehow can are so good that we will be able to transform the world. And I don't think that's the way about it. I think we are limited human beings, and we have to accept the fact that there's something more than us. Something that we can't understand, definitely cannot express through language and scientific concepts.
I'd like to ask you a question about pain of life, because we sometimes run into difficulties, even the sorrow. How did you manage the hard times in your life?
I just, you know, they came and went.
They came and went?
Yeah, they came and went.
Okay. You didn't get identified with the sorrow?
No. I mean, when something sad happened, I was sad. And then sometimes I would think I'm a cold, callous person because I get over tragedy pretty quickly.
But that could be as well a robustness, being robust.
Yes, definitely. I mean,
so you didn't come to a period in your life where you were down. And
the only time I have felt, a long period where I was not depressed, the right term would be I was stressed. And that was in my job, which was tiring me, and I had a big job. But I could see that the future of what I was dealing with, which was brain damage rehabilitation, that the government was going to cut down on all those things, and I didn't want to be part of doing that. And so there was a couple of years where I was fighting with that, and then stopped that work job. Resigned, and went into private practice again.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. They already met each other.
Yeah.
Looking back at your life, your journey there, if you try to get the sense of it, what was it like if somebody can learn of it? Do you know what I mean?
Because
there are some elements in it. You see? You change culture.
Yes.
You adapt.
Yes.
You develop your own view of life.
Yes.
You go on. Somehow you have some robustness in you, so you can manage these transformations.
Yes. I think it's because I was trained in it.
A training? Okay.
Yeah. Right? Because it happens so often. The shifts and so on. There are also things I haven't talked about, but well, there were also these small shifts, and so I was used to. Okay, now it's a new cycle.
Adjust. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. And how do I deal with that?
Right. Mm-hmm. I want to ask a question. So, I mean, you were working with psychology for a very long time, and can you see that there are more and more people who have it difficult nowadays? I mean, through the years, like that the young people have it like more difficult than young people for 30 years ago. Can you see this?
Yes, most definitely. I can see it in my grandkids and other people's kids and so on.
Why do you think this thing?
It's very much to do with the way we bring our kids up.
Okay, but if you could put it like in two sentences or something like this, if you could say it like shortly.
We make them overly sensitive.
Okay.
I mean, we train them in becoming sensitive, as if that was something good, instead of training them in becoming robust.
Robust. Yeah. Okay.
And it's a big difference. I mean, we weren't at least my generation, we weren't trained at all.
Okay.
I mean, we were left alone.
Yeah.
All right. We had our parents there somewhere in the background.
So this to have it difficult is not bad. It's something good that can make you more robust or...
No, it actually wasn't difficult. We were just allowed to be ourselves.
Okay, more.
Yes, we were more independent.
More independent, yes.
We were much more independent, whereas kids nowadays are not at all independent. Everything is planned for them, and the parents are so worried that they are not thriving and that and so on, constantly, shall we say, infiltrating their feelings.
Yes.
By how you feeling? Oh, you mustn't feel any pain. I want to protect you from anything. At the same time, here's a smartphone and leave me alone.
Yeah. Take care of yourself.
Yeah.
This manage life. Yeah. Okay. Maybe it's also because you were talking about what formed what you actually occupied yourself with as a child and then later on as a teenage and so on. I think that a part of this, whether it's Tarzan or it's Carlos Castaneda, these things are together forming a kind of personality that maybe is more what you describe as robust. When I can see what kids today or youngsters today are being exposed to, they're exposed to a totally different world. Idols, you know, that are, I mean, maybe we can say that we grew up on Sound of Music and they grew up on Terminator. You know, there's a difference between how you form your...
Shine, not Terminator, TikTok.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is now, but you can see that the parents that have kids today, they grew up on something else.
Yeah. Yeah?
So the kids of today have a problem. But Mayo, you've chosen also another song to...
Yes.
By the Kinks.
Yes.
By the Kinks. Okay, and it's called Wonder Boy.
Yes.
And it's because very cheerful and very philosophical, you say.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very, what I would call, they're actually a grunge group. I mean, they would have the guys who started heavy. Yeah. But this is not a heavy song. It's a very sweet song. And in a sense, it's all about... You know, seeing the good things in life.
You have to listen to the lyrics. Yeah. Actually, it's more the lyrics than the music.
Yeah, exactly.
The music we can discuss another time. But let's listen to it.
Time is as fast.
you asking?
Yes, Mario, then the last question we have on our list is how do you cope with the criticism of your outlook? I mean, when you meet people that tell you, why do you say like that, or why do you think like that, or this is wrong, or
oh, so yeah, I meet that the whole time.
Yeah, we all do, yeah, in a way.
I mean, the whole time I meet, because we are living in a world where people with great, you know, they think it's great being a humanist. Mm. They don't even know what the word means, right? So so I enjoy
provoking them,
introducing them to what they are actually standing for, right? Because most people are very materialistic in their, even though they don't consider themselves materialistic, they are. They have a outlook on life, which is very what I would consider shallow, where they think that by being nice people, by donating money to this and that, or saying the right things, that they're good people. And to my mind, that's nonsense. And I'm willing to discuss these things with them. And I maybe like a priest, I'm trying to convince them that there are other ways of thinking about stuff. And critical thinking, which I know is something Benjamin is very much for, is, to my mind, very essential. I mean, I question everything, and people think, oh, that's just because you want to be in opposition.
Yeah.
And I don't, that's not how I experience it. I'm not in opposition. I just want to question everything.
That's right. Yeah. And in this sense, you are a very good mirror. Yeah, because you reflect something they don't want to see. But yeah.
What does it mean to be non-materialistic?
Non-materialistic.
Yes.
Well, I mean,
you have a house. Yeah. You're living in a house.
Oh yeah, I live a material life.
Yes.
Yes, I'm not a monk.
Yes. No.
No, but when we're talking about philosophical themes, yes, and what's right and what's wrong, yeah, in life, I would like to see people waking up to what they actually stand for.
Okay.
I mean, I don't mind being a hypocrite. I mean, but at least I know when I'm being a hypocrite.
And they don't.
No.
No, that's right. This is a self-deception, as they call it.
So, what I mean, if you consider a human being to be materialistic, like, how do you define it? Like, if you say, okay,
no, it's the way. I mean, for example, you could take a very scientific view.
Okay.
Everything in life can be
explained
rationally, and so on. Then you're a materialist.
Okay,
I don't mean that you like a big car and that sort of stuff. I'm talking about the philosophical.
So you're saying that you know everything, that everything can be proved.
Yeah, and if not today, then tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
Right.
I understand it. Yes.
Mario, thanks a lot for your presentation of your person and personality and your views. That was great to hear. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you want to play music, or shall I start right now?
You can start straight away.
Okay, so I start the same. I'm trying to present myself with some, replying some of the questions. The first one is, can you briefly describe your physical and social background as a child? Yes, so I grew up on a kibbutz, in the 40s, and it was a communal lifestyle where we had no means to. It was all owned by the kibbutz members, yeah. And it was a very special experience in certain senses. For the first, the generation of our parents' generation, they were all traumatized by the Holocaust. They lost all their families in Poland in the 40s. They left Poland in the 36, and they witnessed that all their families were gone. Now, they tried to shield us from this tragedy, so they didn't talk with us about this matter. So we grew up as a new generation. They call us the son generation, son children. You know, you start a new world, you create a kibbutz, Israel is on its way to become a nation. We grew up in contrast with all the tragedy they experienced. On top of this tragedy, there was a war of independence in 47-48, and the kibbutz in the south part of Israel was encircled by Egyptian troops, and they bombed the kibbutz to shreds. And I didn't know this, but we were sent back out of the kibbutz a day before they bombed our houses. So it was a miracle that we survived altogether. When we come back to the kibbutz, a lot of people died, a lot of people were injured, but they created for us a narrative. And the narrative was that Jews will never, never, never again go to the slaughterhouse. We fought and we won, and we have to be all the time prepared to fight for our right to existence. This is something they put very much stress on. On the same time, there was another narrative, the narrative of creating a new society, creating a new human, and creating a new world. And we were in solidarity with all the people in the world, especially workers. So we grew up on these two narratives, which what they meant. In fact, that from the very start, you realize you can't dream. You have to be in a reality. Yet, I was also reading Tarzan. I was also in fantasy. So all the time, you know, there is a split up.
Yes.
I couldn't imagine that people are angels, because I saw what happened. And I knew that the history of Jewish people means that you have to be prepared to fight. But yet, we could dream about a better world and how we can impact it and how we can become a better human being. So it was also a vision in it and a mission in it. And there was also the literature which brought us to Tarzan, to Ivanhoe, all these kind of things. So it was a mixture. And there was the nature, which played a really great role in my life, and the work. We had to work all the time. We have to work, and there was no this ego trip story. We were all together in a group. Mm-hmm. The children grew up in a house of children, so the parents 2 hours a day. Some say that it damaged their capacity to love, but it was what it was.
Yes.
So all together, referring to Mario, the different experiences there made, I look at myself, so what it made me more or less tough. So I also lost a lot of people, but I say, okay, opla di, opla da, life goes on. So you lose some of this sensitivity, but on the other hand, you gain some robustness, so you don't break down from everything. So this was what my childhood meant to me. Yeah. So after child, what shaped your life? You
can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
What was your first like a memory as a child? Like the very first.
First memory?
Yeah, the first memory is the very first.
The first memory was I wake up in the night, and there is a big sound. A bomb was cast just close to our house. I remember there was the light glimpsed. You know what the light
explosion? Yeah,
the flash,
and the sound. That's something what I remember. Right?
So it was the first memory of child.
When I become to register anything.
Okay.
And then a little bit on the way where we were brought out of the kibbutz, because the kibbutz was encircled, so we had to travel alone in some of these armored vehicles, and we shouldn't cry, and some of the children got I didn't know this then, but they got something to sleep, so they didn't cry because so this was and I was in the armored
How old were you?
About three years old.
Because I remember that I couldn't reach the bottom of the car, so I was afraid. So I remember this. So, but they come as flash back.
Did you feel happy as a child?
What?
did you feel happy as a child?
I was happy as a child can be, but okay. When I came back to the kibbutz after the war, I didn't want to do anything with my parents, but I didn't see them for such a long time. So I ran away. And the kibbutz fields were mined, said to me, my mother had to run after me in the minefield. So it was such a... made the foundation of my person is that, okay, life can be hard, like life can be harsh, people can be beast-like, but there is a hope and you can build on it, you know, and you don't give up, more or less this was what they tried to convey to us, mm-hmm. that this attitude. So this was this, this one, how did you break free from groupthink and conventional norms? I didn't break out up to the age of 40s. I was a nice guy. I conformed. I did all what I was expected to.
But what does this mean? Like groupthink in kibbutz, it felt like really much.
Marx, socialism.
Okay, Marx. Yeah. Okay.
We had the same view and we didn't.
The same, like the everybody.
The same, and we didn't differ. I mean, my father was a communist, so there was no place to differ. So the personal views, they didn't really mature.
But you had some discussions in the groups or something,
yes.
No?
Yes, but the framework was this. We are the best society. We are trying to show the other people in the world how to create a better world. This was something we were fostered with, you know.
Yes. This is,
so what really happens that all these years, I'm doing what people expected me to do. I'm going to war twice, because if I couldn't imagine I would just run away. But when I come back to when I come to Denmark,
yes.
Something happens. For the first, you get out of this, it is like a pressure group. You know, they tell you what to think and you are not going to... differ because it means exclusion,
consequences. Yeah.
Very gaga. And then something happens. When I'm in Denmark, there is a wave of anti-Israelis who left Israel because they consider us as traitors.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
It was such a huge, a terrible attitude towards people. Didn't ask why. Didn't try to figure. They said we are traitors. And I react to such an accusation in the papers. And then the one who wrote about us that we were worse than a prostitute. He writes an article about me that he hates me because he doesn't know me. And I'm blah 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 blah. So I react again. There comes the too much, and then they attacked me in the newspaper from all sides. In the kibbutz, they attacked me from all sides, and I remember I said, "This is too much. I give fuck on them. I don't want any longer to listen to what they say. Mm-hmm. I get back to Denmark, and I'm so angry. 3 months, and I'm over on the other side. Nobody's going to intimidate me for the rest of my life." So it was a collision.
Yes.
It was a confrontation with the background, also with the stories. So this is how I became difficult.
Mm. No. This is how you became easy.
Yeah, it was, in a way, the fight was very hard because you had to say, well, I'm not going any longer to be intimidated.
Mm.
Because we were intimidated in the kibbutz.
Well, I grew up in a different era than you did. So 20 years later, many things happened.
Yeah, that's right.
But Benjamin, should we listen to... you haven't sent me any music. I've chosen a song that I know that you like very much.
Yes.
It's called Nature Boy by Nat King Cole.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Let's listen to it.
A very strange, enchanted boy. They say he wandered very far, very far, over land and sea. A little shy, a
and sad of eye, but very wise was he. And then one day, a magic day, he passed my way. And while we spoke of many things, fools and kings, this he said to me: the greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return.
Question: how did you handle a criticism of your worldview? Well, that took me a long time to figure out how to handle, because I was writing and I was writing a little bit out of mainstream, and I think some people got provoked. Why don't you write so you can sell a lot of books and earn a lot of money and have success? I was not interested in it. I was interested much more in the far-sighted horizons. That's one thing. Another thing is, how do you write about future? How can we guess anything about the future? And I was all the time writing from the point of view of probabilities, what can happen. I didn't say God kissed my ears and told me how to say, this is my view of things. So in the beginning, when I started to write, I reacted with dismay and frustration. I didn't understand why they don't see what I see. So it was this feeling, yeah. Over time, I approach criticism with a little bit amusement and patience, because it became also for me, I could write something which could sell much better, but I was sort of, fixed on this matter. So I said, you have to accept that this is what really bears in your soul. So in the meantime, some of my analysis of the state of the world, they became validated. So things are in a way terrible, but they turn out to fit in my analysis of what's going on. So I got... Maybe like Mario, I got a little bit philosophical. Do you know what? I think generation ahead. I think maybe what may happen in 500 years, 600 years, or something like this. And then without knowing it, a great help for me be presented the science fiction and then the technology, yes, which opens from possibilities. Yeah, I think like you that we went astray. We went into this individualistic, material world, and we are just, yeah.
When did it happen that you think we went astray? Like, how long ago did it happen? Like, at what point the humanity, went astray?
I think that I sometimes find a correlation between losing God and finding greed. Do you understand what I mean?
No.
When people start, when they lose the feeling that there is something greater than them.
Okay.
And they become, I'm the center of the world.
Yeah, and when did it happen? Was it in the 60s?
In the 80s.
In
the 80s, it became very, very apparent for me.
I think it would happen much earlier.
Much earlier.
Because if you look at Darwin, Newton, and all, Einstein even, they were all religious people.
Yes.
To some extent, so that it combines science with religion.
Yeah.
But sometime after the Enlightenment and the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, It started.
It started.
Yeah.
So like first slowly and now it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I found out because I was starting to compare a statistic of a mental illness, which begin to soar in the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is, so I know something is wrong in the way we put all the stress on me.
Yes.
And you know, and it turned out right because there were more narcissists and there were psychopaths and people are suffering of feeling of insufficiency. They can't really manage somebody who is harsh on them. So I figure out if we create society, and the society has to be good for people. So we are on the wrong direction.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm finished. Shai, okay, now it's your turn.
Yes, it was very interesting. Actually, I will start with a piece of music because I think that for me, music from the very beginning was something that formed me as a person. Mainly because my mother was playing a piano and I always listened to all this classical music. So the piece of music will be Preludium number 2 and Fugue number 2 of Johann Sebastian Bach. Interesting. Okay, now we go back and we start. Benjamin, now it's my turn, right? First, I grew up in a kibbutz, as Benjamin grew up. Different kibbutz, different place in Israel. It's the north part of Israel on the Syrian border. We were about 300 meters from the border, which means that my childhood... Most of my childhood, we were running into bomb shelters and every second day and so on, until the Six Days War, when Israel took over the Golan Heights, which were the kibbutz is just under the Golan Heights. This fear that disappeared within 6 days was a great thing, because for us kids, it was always the feeling of when do we have to run to the bomb shelter? And it was, for children living in the middle of Israel, this problem, of course, was not existent. A part of my childhood, what I remember from my childhood, is, of course, the war and the fear that is connected to what can happen. And, of course, all the funerals of the people that got killed once in a while and so on. That means exposure to death in very early stage. When you ask what can be significant to for further development as a teenage, I think that when I what I remember from my teenage years is, again, introduction to music. It was poetry. It was in the form of Bob Dylan. It was a form of Leonard Cohen. It was songs about things that were foreign to me on that time, but which I felt very related to, in a way. So this was a kind of... I wouldn't call it wake up, but it was a kind of thing that influenced my outlook later on. I think that life, in a way, forms us as we are through the experiences we go through. And of course, we all go through experiences that we maybe preferred not to be exposed to. For me, it was like being in the army for 3 years, going into wars, not the same kind of wars you had, because I was a canonist, but from long distance, the wars in Lebanon that were going on all the time. I think that what happened to me through the army, because I was a pacifist, of course, and I was not so much
into... When you say, of course, it was pretty unusual.
I think yes. I think that our background, yeah. For example, I don't remember that we had enemy relationship to the Syrians on the border. We were afraid of the war, but we were not afraid of the
people.
Syrians, like Syrians. I mean, we didn't see them as bad people, which is very different from your time, because I think when you grew up, there was a very definite enemy and the Arabs, you know, and all this. We grew in a different time where there was much more openness towards looking into the future, especially after the Six Days War, where Israel established a zone, a buffer zone in the Golan Heights that, in a way, did make everything more secure than it was before. So I can say that in a way, not feeling comfortable, or what we call suffering, is a stimuli to further development. It was for me, anyway, to start searching into esoteric schools, trying to figure out what are the potential of a human being. I think that... what I heard here, there is a lot of politic in what we are talking about. I mean, whether we take this viewpoint or that viewpoint. But basically, my quest was more like looking on things from away, from above, and trying to recognize the mechanism that is behind the dire situation that humanity is in. And I recognized very quickly that the self-development that people should have maybe relate to or take action in never took place. That means that we don't, as human beings, we don't use the capacity or the possibility that we have as human beings for self-development. Self-development, it sounds very bad because people say, oh, okay, this person is only thinking about himself. But it's nothing to do with that. It's exactly the opposite. It's actually to create a kind of process that by becoming more understanding and getting the ends to meet somewhere, one is becoming a better person.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you, because this is a matter which you came to again and again. Does it frustrate you that people are not capable of doing it?
No. It doesn't. I don't criticize other people. I mean, my viewpoint is that we can operate in life on different platforms. The platform we see around us, you call it materialism or whatever you describe it on, that is one platform. There is another platform that is spiritual, but within each platform there are sub-platforms. That means every person operates on his own and according to his historical development, and that is what shape...
But does it mean that... you don't really feel frustration or
absolutely not. Absolutely. Things cannot be different as long as people as people don't do the work needed in order to use our potentials. If we don't develop our potential, don't use our potentials, then it will always be the same. It will always return to the same point. So to dream about a different future is daydreaming for me, because the work as work is that is needed in order to shift from one platform to another, and it's not a higher platform or lower platform, it's just a different platform.
How do you feel about you made a great move at the age of 19, you moved to Denmark, so there is also this matter, how did you manage this?
I didn't have any problem with it. Okay. I never felt identified. I think we have to describe what identified is, because for example, if a person buy a house, if the house becomes a part of you, like Buddhists say, if you have more than three things, then they owe you and you don't owe them. This is another viewpoint, but let's say that it's also the relationship that one has to the things one have. I can give an example. I hear quite often people that have been the house have been broken in, and somebody been there and looking on their things or stole some things, they feel very bad about it. And I cannot recognize this feeling. I have been exposed to theft, and I didn't have this feeling because I don't feel like relationship to this.
Because we couldn't relate, because we all the time change places, right?
I don't think so much that, but it can be because in the kibbutz we lived like we had one bicycle for 20 kids. So we never owed anything personally. And I remember the presents that we gave on birthdays, they were always moving from one kid to another. It was the same presents because we never introduced anything new. So everybody knew, okay, this time I'm going to get this from that, because you could remember what they had and so on. So I think that the way that we choose, in a way, I mean, this we have free choice. I don't believe in free choice, but the way that free choice is explained to ordinary people is that you can choose your life.
Do you believe in free will?
No, I don't. I don't believe that it exists as a possibility on the stage that we live. I don't. I cannot recognize it.
So people, in your view, kind of a semi-automatic.
No, people take decisions according to the historical, what history they have. That means what formed them. So that means that when you identify yourself with the form that you have achieved, then it's, of course, for you, you feel like you take the decision. But even today, you can see with the neuropsychology that when you test the, when you look at the brain, then actually the decision is being made in the brain before you take a decision whether you want ice cream of vanilla or chocolate. So,
what does it mean, a free will?
Exactly.
What's mean?
Free will, it means for most people, it means that they have the possibility to choose. To choose their actions. Okay.
Yes.
Where you can say that.
And you mean we can't do it?
No, I say that we, our will, or what we describe as will, is dictated by our past and by our momentary situation. Okay. That means the decision that you, let's say, Olga, you take a decision 10 o'clock at night that you want to wake up 3 o'clock in the morning and go for a walk. 3 o'clock in the morning, the Olga that has to get up will be totally different than the Olga that took the decision, which means most probably what can happen is that you are not going to wake up, or you will have to force yourself to wake up.
And it's not free.
Well, it depends, free for who. The one who took the decision, the Olga that took the decision, is subjected to the present situation that she was under, and the one who has to excavate the decision.
Okay. Was it a free will to come to Denmark? also for you?
No, in a way, no. Okay. Because of the same with Benjamin. I also felt like in a way that I was pushed away from the place where I was living. Free will? No, it was dictated.
Achai, there's something about your life story, which I know a little bit. Which may indicate that you use sometimes free will. Generally speaking, most people choose the solutions which don't demand too much thinking, they don't demand too much effort, generally speaking. And you, for example, you have chosen to be a Buddhist friend, which is demanding, which is very hard, and you often
Buddhist
friend.
The idea of Buddhist friend is a person that is so irritating to you that it requires you to work on yourself.
How many of these friends you have?
I think that you can find them everywhere, basically. relationships but, with other people always demand.
Do you have like friends, like not Buddhistic.
Probably, sure.
You
it's not like this.
It's not a nudist friend, yes, not a Buddhist.
The question is more that when a person demands you to work on yourself, you know, when you are being irritated or when you are being angry at somebody, then instead of reflecting on that person, your anger and whatever, you have to work on yourself. Okay? For example,
this is a very conscious decision.
This is observation. This is, I think that in my outlook of worldview is that the basic for any development is observation. But the observation must come from a place or from an entity that is not me. That means that I have to create a new identity or a new observing self that we look on things through special glasses, and not the same like when you get identified with politics or hatred or whatever.
So you kind of, you have to step back all the time and kind of
Observe from the side.
You don't identify with your ego. You're just aware of.
Because the ego is a false personality, basically, that has been created through our history. Upbringing, army life, whatever one has been exposed to.
It's really interesting that you developed this part, because what I think I learned from the kibbutz, very, very fundamental. If I say something, I do it. Walk and talk. So, and I found it in fact very useful, because I don't use much energy about looking at myself. I just do things. You know what I mean? Yeah. And you develop this attitude. It's really.
I think that it's coming down to the fact that if you choose a certain way, to work on yourself, or to maybe change yourself in some manner, using your potentials, actually, then I mean it's a kind of thing that you get into your system, and observations are being made constantly. I mean, you look at people on the streets. You have to remember yourself. You have to remember your aim or your objective. Okay, what you describe as semi-automatic is because most people are going through life, or we go through life, daydreaming. We are not focused constantly, which means very quickly our attention is being is shifting from one thing to another, and it can be this chaos that people feel quite often.
And they identify with those shifts.
Of course, yeah. So, and every
that's
time.
That's what creates the ego.
Yeah.
It's that constant identification. For example, I think, right? I identify with thoughts. But these thoughts, where do they come from?
Exactly.
Yeah. Right? An ego would say, oh, they're my thoughts. A Buddhist or a Hindu would say, no, they're not your thoughts. Okay. You're just aware of those thoughts and you are identifying with them.
Yeah. I would say when a person say I, then actually it's a bit strange thing to say, because who is talking? Is it the very moment I that a person have at this? We all know we are shifting through emotional and whatever stages through the day. Every one of them can be described as a personality, basically.
Yeah. Shai, but back to you. I have known you for a very long time. You are a very good fella. Very good fella. One of the best. When is the project finished?
Never. I mean, this is what life is about.
Have you heard about reincarnation?
And even reincarnation doesn't finish anything.
I want to ask you something. Like, when you have this, like a life view, that you are a bit like you step back and looking on the things a bit like from outside. I mean, how about this, like? Don't you feel lonely sometimes?
No.
Not at all?
No.
Okay.
Because I think that first, I mean, it's when you occupy yourself with that.
Yes.
I mean, you see, people who believe in God in a certain way, they will all the time feel that somebody is looking at them. Okay, observing them. I mean, that is the traditional religious take on that. Yeah.
No, that's the anthropomorphic take on religion.
On religion, maybe. But this is, for many people who practice religion, as I know from the Jews in Israel, for example, there is a judging God. There is, a God that is demanding from you a certain behavior. And I think that the difference is that here, in this way of work, it's you. That a certain part of you that decides to do the work, not because of fear, not because of a promise to get something out of it, but just in order to go through life in a meaningful way. And the meaning of life is, we know, or we think we know, that is what one creates. What one is doing. And the people who believe that God put us here in order to have a special role, that is another viewpoint. Mm. And this is, I mean, I respect all viewpoints in a way, because that is how people are different, and we are different.
Mm.
But some things lead to a certain place that is maybe a bit better for me personally. And that's it.
One could also say that it's presumptuous to say, I want to live a better life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I want to improve myself, right? Yeah. No, it's better to say, I want to help others, right?
But this comes when one have the capacity to help others.
Yeah.
And help,
I remember, because of my background, I was twice in war and I was an officer. So sometimes when I was lying in bed, what I really did in my mind, I was fighting the Syrians. Mm-hmm. It was the battlefield. Then with the years, it turned out I fight, but I have to fight something which means helping something. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it kind of transformed there. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the ego was not very important. It was important what you do.
This is one of the main things when I was treating other people suffering from severe anxiety or depression, very often the best way of getting them out of that was, how can you be of use to your sister?
Yeah, precisely.
Instead of, oh, how can I alleviate my pain?
Precisely.
No. Yeah. How can you alleviate your sister's pain?
Yeah.
So the moving focus from me to you.
So when you're weak, you can be strong with someone else.
Yes.
Yeah,
to help
and that way you become strong.
Yeah.
Yes.
Precisely.
Okay.
Shai, you said that we have not much time. I want to.
We have 10 minutes.
We have 10 minutes. Okay, so we can just go on.
It's a very long time. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think, in fact, this is the key sentence.
Mm-hmm.
In the long run, we have to go to come away from this point. My focus, my importance, my success, my fame, whatever, because it is something which destroys people. People generally speaking, if they are only for themselves, they are just mayflies. Mm-hmm. They live without any meaning for...
But Benjamin, there is a little bit, small difference between ego trips, or, you know, let's say individuals that have a certain way of life,
yeah,
and egoists. I mean, you are talking about egoism that we see today in society
is very much
quite egoistic. Yeah, but that is not. I mean, when you work on yourself, you have only yourself to work on. You can work through looking on other people, observations and whatever, but the work has to be done on yourself. You cannot get, how do you say, you cannot change things within yourself just by helping other people, because some of the things that are might be a problem for one are not a problem for another. So you have to recognize what is that you want to work on.
But you know what, because I try to view this question,
mm-hmm,
how do you use your life in a meaningful way?
Mm-hmm.
What really helped me to get it in my, in a way which I could live in peace with, I was in war, I could kill people, I didn't kill people. Which means that I was a person who was not brutal or terrible, and I am not going after people in order to destroy them. That was enough. So we are finished with Benjamin. Now we see what Benjamin does in this world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to work so much about myself. It's good enough for me that I'm a decent person.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to that?
Again, Benjamin,
Olga,
I mean,
what do you say?
I mean, I think that it's
when does it turn to be on a knee, and when it is useful? You know, understand my question.
That depends on what you choose or what you are being exposed to, Benjamin.
Yeah.
Because I think that, of course, it's to be a decent person and to treat other people decently is very important, of course. Yeah. I think there is some kind of universal moral principles that most cultures will agree about. And, you know, if you are within this line, then it's okay. But it's still not the potential that I think that we have a larger potential than that.
Somehow.
I think everybody have. But
you think so?
The
like
question...
Larger potential to... like.
That means, for example, the way we operate through life, no matter what culture you will choose, people will have more or less the same problems to deal with. Maybe some have a house made of mud and some have out of bricks. It doesn't matter. Still, what is important, what fundament one built for his own structure in life. And where you put the windows, where you put the doors, it doesn't matter. But you need windows and doors. So I think that...
So what is the most important in life?
That is, depends on a person, if you
on
ask
the person,
me.
Okay.
I don't think there is a universal importance.
For you.
I think is to get closer to the potential that I have as a person.
Okay.
And if what is necessary is to change very basic things within me, I do that, as I've done before. So, I mean, it's not something that I can give you examples of,
no,
but I will say that this transition from one stage to another stage is something that most people do constantly, but they always shift back and forth. Well, I try to not higher, further.
Further,
yeah,
okay.
Because when you say higher, then people always feel like you want to become a better higher person, or higher individual, or whatever. I
so
don't know.
So where are you heading to?
I don't. I will know when I get there.
Because I don't think this is a question of putting goals up.
Okay, it's not a goal.
It's not a goal in itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, to do the right thing.
Yes.
To do what you can do as well as possible. That's enough. That's enough. To be aware of that is enough. It is not because I want to become a saint. Mm. So how am I going to become a saint And that I think is one of the first things you have to learn if you're a monk or whatever is that that's not the way of doing it. It's like saying people are pursuing happiness, right? For me, that's the wrong goal. I mean, that's not a goal you can have. Happiness comes.
Some glimpse.
Happiness
has very short, like.
It's something that occurs when you do something good.
Yeah.
Right? Then you might be feel happy.
Yeah.
Mm. Right? But you can't say, I want to feel happy. Mm. What do I do to feel happy? Mm. Oh, a new car will make me happy. Yeah, yeah, it made me happy for 2 weeks and then I'm not happy anymore. Mm. Right? I mean.
Mm. And there comes the dilemma, which is, again, realizing what reality is. You can think the way you think. You can think the way you think. A person with a very low intelligence will never think this way and will never realize this potential.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't think that it's... I don't think...
Because you need some abstraction. Yeah. You need some analysis. You know what I mean?
I disagree with you.
I don't...
I disagree with you. I've met what you would call simple people, intellectually simple people who are far more noble than a lot of intelligent people.
Okay, we'll close the program slowly.
I want to say some words.
You have to say some words.
Thank you very much for the contribution of your life experience. And there was something common for us three. Mm-hmm. We are trying to transcend, to get a little bit all the material life to find meaning which is more common, unifying for all people.
And you are trying not to be selfish speaking about yourself.
Yeah. Olga, thanks a lot for your question and your comments. Thanks a lot for this time.
Yeah, let's listen to Bob Dylan. The 2 minutes we have left on.
Sun and moon, to understand you know too soon, there's no sense in trying. As pointed threats they bluff with scorn, suicide remarks are torn from the fool's gold mouthpiece, the hollow horn plays wasted words, proves to warn that he not busy being born is busy dying. Temptation's page flies out the door. You follow, find yourself at war. Watch waterfalls of pity roar. You feel the moan, but unlike before, you discover that you just be one more person crying. So don't fear if you hear a foreign sound to your ear. It's all right, Ma. I'm only sighing. As some warn victory, some downfall, private reasons, great or small, can be seen in the eyes of those that call to make all that should be killed to crawl, while others say don't hate nothing at all except hatred. Disillusion, words like bullets bark, as human gods aim for their mark, make everything from